This morning and I looked around, I said to myself, what have I found? I got a funny feeling that there's something wrong. Went into the kitchen to find the food was gone. Went to the bedroom and put on my clothes. Walked into the street to find the shops were closed. There were no trams running and the petrol was all gone. People in a panic, all hysterical and crying. So we all yelled out, forgive us, please save us from ourselves. And please turn it on, we'll never do the same again. No radios were going.
G'day fellow Israelites and welcome to episode 5 of Christian Identity Australia, a podcast, and you're listening to it, that deals in those two rare and unpopular commodities, biblical and racial truth. They're rare because the apostate racially contaminated society in which we live rejects both. And both are inextricably linked, for the Bible is as much about race as it is about spirit. Most modern churches will tell you that race is irrelevant in this New Testament age because, as they assert, Christ died for all men, white, black, yellow, red, and every you in between. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says he came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So when it says he died for all men, he did die for all men, or Israelite men, and of course, or Israelite women. Scripture tells us that he came in the likeness of man, that is, the likeness of the men he came to redeem. Did he come as a black-skinned African or a slant-eyed Asian? No, he came as a fair-complexioned man, a white man. He didn't come as a swarthy, hook-nosed, frizzy-haired Jew. He was of the tribe of Judah, but that made him a Judahite, not a Jew. Jews don't belong to any Israel tribe. Christ was a white man because Israelites were and are white. And it's in white countries like America, England, Germany, and Australia where the Israelites can be found today hiding in plain sight under a variety of names but known collectively as white Europeans. Israel is not a place, it's a people. You won't find a place called Israel anywhere in the Bible. It's quite significant that a race of non-Israelite people who masquerade as Jews but are not Jews, not in the Judahite or Judean senses of the word, would live in a place they call Israel, but is not Israel and never will be Israel. Christ called this race of people the children of the devil, and like their father, they lie about everything, including who they are and where they live. Now, please forgive my rudeness for not introducing myself earlier. I'm Obadiah 118, or Obi for short, and I am your host, or I was the last time I looked, and I'm also commandant of the ChristianIdentityForum.net. Speaking of which, if you're a regular visitor to my forum, you may have been greeted by one of those dreaded, "This website is temporarily unavailable" messages recently. What happened was I found myself buried under an avalanche of bills and was struggling to dig myself out. I only had enough money to pay some of them on time, so I told my web host, Host Monster, I'd be 1 to 2 weeks late paying my bill. I've been with them for about 5 years, and that was the first time I would have made a late payment. They informed me by email that they'd keep the forum online until the 27th of March, but on the 21st of March they took it offline. Thanks, Host Monster. The lesson to be learned here, fellow Israelites, is that an emailed assurance from a web hosting company is not worth the pixels it's written on. Okay, that bit of housekeeping's out of the way. Now it's time for another bit of housekeeping. What became of the weekly Australian Racist News Report? Well, I didn't have the time to continue with it, so I gave it the flick. That simple. My one and only podcast from now on is this podcast, Christian Identity Australia, which I'll be publishing with my usual consistent inconsistency. You know, I really ought to endeavour to turn these podcasts out quicker and with a bit more regularity to build something of a following, but my time is limited at the moment. Anyway, we'll see how we go. We'll be right back. Marks the 20th anniversary of the Port Arthur Massacre, which took place on the 28th of April 1996 in a popular tourist site in Tasmania. The Channel 7 Current Affairs show, Sunday Night, recently devoted a whole episode to the massacre, a good portion of which focused on a videotape police interrogation of the alleged killer, Martin Bryant. The videotape hadn't been seen by the public before. To the average person, the footage would have done nothing to prove Bryant's innocence. But to a conspiracy realist like me, it did nothing to prove his guilt. As a matter of fact, after watching the interview, I'm more convinced of Bryant's innocence than I ever was. This is the intro by the show's presenter, Mel Doyle.
Australia was scarred forever by the horrors at Port Arthur 20 years ago. Tonight, for the first time, the mystery and mythology that's developed around mass murderer Martin Bryant will come crashing down. You'll be able to see him for what he is, as we see the killer questioned at length for the very first time. Hello, I'm Melissa Doyle. Welcome to Sunday Night. 35 people died when Bryant ran amok with his arsenal of weapons at the busy tourist destination of Port Arthur in Tasmania. This appalling crime wounded many more, scarred the nation, shocked the world, and changed us forever. It prompted a Prime Minister to disarm Australia, and thankfully we've not seen such bloodshed since. We've also never seen or heard from Bryant himself. And in that vacuum, he's become an enigma. Like many grotesque criminals locked away out of sight, he's become larger than life. Tonight, his lawyer, his psychiatrist, and his girlfriend will break their silence to reveal new insights into the criminal mind of Australia's worst mass murderer. But even more revealing is the video of the police interrogation of Bryant. It's never been shown outside court. For some of you, this will no doubt bring back painful memories. A little later tonight, we will pay tribute to the victims of the Port Arthur Massacre. But we hope tonight's program will help us all better understand one of our darkest days. Mike Willacy leads our special investigation.
Doyle talks about how the mystery and mythology surrounding Bryant will come crashing down. By mythology, she means the belief held by many white Australian patriots, myself included, that Bryant was framed for the massacre and didn't kill anybody at Port Arthur. She says the massacre prompted our then Prime Minister, John Howard, to, in her words, disarm Australia, which was the whole point of the Port Arthur massacre. This next clip is from an interview the reporter Mike Willacy did with Bryant's lawyer, John Avery.
I thought, Christ, what's this fellow going to be like? Is he Hannibal Lecter-like? Is he just plain evil?
Representing Martin Bryant, his new lawyer, John Avery, appointed after Bryant had pleaded not guilty 6 weeks ago.
And like in your own words, you went there for that first meeting with a sense of trepidation.
Yeah, I did. It was pretty soon dispelled, I might say, when he was wheeled in a wheelchair with his legs manacled and handcuffed and with a big grin on his face like a big schoolboy. I didn't any longer see any connection with Hannibal Lecter.
Why are you speaking now?
It's a way of me finally putting the Martin Bryant saga behind me. It's it's been around in some ways for so long that hopefully now I can bury it.
Avery, said Bryant, had a big grin on his face, and if you saw the footage, and it's available online, I've included a link to it in the show notes on my forum, Bryant's either grinning or giggling. Naturally, the average viewer concludes that Bryant is a whack job who treated the massacre like it was all a big joke and that he's where he belongs in prison. However, there's a good reason for Bryant's levity, and we'll look at that soon. Now, John Avery is an interesting character. One thing you probably noticed when it comes to government-orchestrated frame-ups like this is that the person being framed is almost always lumbered with a crooked lawyer. One of the most recent examples of this is the late American pro-white attorney Edgar J. Steele, who was framed for the attempted murder of his wife. Not only did Steele have to deal with a corrupt judge who disallowed crucial evidence in his case, but he also had to deal with two corrupt lawyers, the first of whom was an alcoholic who was being sued for drunken misconduct, and the second was facing disbarment for embezzling clients' money. In 2009, Avery was sent to prison for 3 years after pleading guilty to the misappropriation of funds and 129 counts of stealing. Avery wasn't Bryant's first lawyer, but his second. Bryant initially and repeatedly pled not guilty to the murder charges he was facing. That was until Avery, under nebulous circumstances, took over his case. Then Bryant changed his plea to guilty, but only after he'd been held in solitary confinement illegally for almost 7 months. It was illegal because Bryant had not been convicted of a crime. The last thing the government wants when it's trying to frame somebody is for the defending lawyer to have a sudden attack of conscience. So what it does is appoint one of dubious integrity. But the Sunday night program portrayed Avery as something of a hero. Even when Avery's criminal convictions are being discussed, Willacy remarks how brave he was for confessing to his crimes. Predictably, Avery proved to be one lousy defence lawyer. His brief was to get Bryant to plead guilty at all costs, and this even comes across in the interview. A lawyer's job is to defend his client regardless of whether the client pleads guilty or not guilty. And the client, under the law, has a right to plead not guilty, even if every shred of evidence indicates otherwise. But this little fact was of no concern to Avery. As it turned out, Bryant never went to trial for his alleged crimes. John Howard, who saw to it that legislation outlawing semi-automatic and self-loading rifles and shotguns was rushed through Parliament soon after the massacre, justified this on the grounds that it would have forced witnesses to relive the horrors of that terrible day. What a joke of an excuse that was! Every day in our courts, people have to relive horrific events on the witness stand. Rape, torture, child molestation, murder, and often in the most excruciating detail. Nobody ever excuses them from testifying because it would be too upsetting for them. The government didn't want the case going to trial because even with everything zipped up tight in its favour, there still was a chance that the truth might slip out. The original plan was for Bryant to perish in the fire at the Seascape cottage, eliminating the need for a trial. Unfortunately for the government, and perhaps unfortunately for Bryant as well, he managed to survive. In this next clip, we hear from Paul Mullen, the forensic psychiatrist who examined Bryant. Like Avery, Mullen is a man of questionable character, which I'll discuss after the clip.
To understand how Bryant had become a cold-blooded killer, Avery needed to get inside his head. He hired forensic psychiatrist Professor Paul Mullen.
All that was required to get him talking and keep him talking was to show an interest.
It was all about him.
Yes, absolutely, all about him. Bryant was a good-looking young man, blonde, blue-eyed, handsome, childlike. One of the problems, I think, throughout Bryant's life is that he looked an attractive kid, he looked an attractive adolescent, he looked an attractive adult. He also looked an intelligent kid, an intelligent adolescent, and an intelligent adult, but he wasn't. So people who met him had expectations of what he'd be able to say and do and how he'd react, which he couldn't live up to.
Mullen, well known for his anti-firearms views, is the person the Australian government always turns to when it needs a psychiatric report of an Australian mass shooter. It's intriguing that Mullen was living in Melbourne at the time of the Hoddle Street massacre in 1987. Then he moved to the New Zealand town of Aramoana just before 13 people were shot dead there in a mass shooting in 1990. Then he moved back to Melbourne in time for the Port Arthur massacre. Although Melbourne is in the state of Victoria and Port Arthur is in the island state of Tasmania, the two states are only an hour away from each other by plane. This is part of what Mullen had to say about Bryant in a written psychiatric evaluation he did for Avery. Quote, Mr. Bryant was assessed on a number of occasions by psychologists and psychiatrists. He was noted to be aggressive, destructive, and very difficult with other children. There are references to him stealing, to him having violent outbursts, and to tormenting vulnerable children. There are records of Mr. Bryant torturing and harassing animals and of tormenting his sister. Unquote. Mullen claims that Bryant treated other children aggressively when he was a child. But then you could say this about a lot of boys. Boys get into scraps with other boys and sometimes even girls. That's just normal behaviour. Now, some boys are more aggressive than others, but that doesn't make them potential mass murderers. Maybe Bryant was more aggressive than his peers when he was a boy, but that was most likely because he was frustrated from not being able to keep up with them socially and academically. If Bryant's alleged aggression as a child presaged his behaviour as an adult, then the people who knew him as an adult would be able to confirm that it did. But they don't. In fact, they paint a vastly different picture of him from the one Mullen paints. This is an audio grab of a report on Bryant that A Current Affair did not long after the massacre.
These children used to play with Martin Bryant, their next-door neighbour. They go over to his house and he gave them gifts. A TV for Ben One, a doll for Evelina, and a CD player for Asher.
Because Asher sent me the CD, oh, that's cool, and he goes, oh, you can have it if you like.
And then we saw another one that was better, and he goes, oh, you can have that one if you want.
I think he was lonely.
The Coopers became friendly with Bryant, who they thought was immature but harmless.
It was all gentle and didn't say anything to hurt you.
Yeah, and you'd never think that he hurt anyone or anything like that, because he just was really nice to everyone.
According to the children who lived next door to Bryant, he was harmless, gentle, and the kind of person who would never hurt anyone. This is what Petra Wilmot, Bryant's girlfriend at the time of the massacre, had to say about him in the same A Current Affair report.
Petra Wilmot was the last person to get close to Martin Bryant. A shy country girl, she applied for a job as his part-time gardener. She became his full-time girlfriend. He was her first boyfriend. Why did you fall in love with him?
Probably because he was gentle and kind and he'd look after me.
As Wilmot said in that clip, Bryant was gentle, kind and looked after her. This is a far cry from the cruel fiend depicted by Mullen in Bryant's psychiatric report. In this next and very revealing clip from Channel 7's Sunday Night program, Mike Willacy interviews an earlier girlfriend of Bryant's.
In 1995, a year before the Port Arthur massacre, Mary was Bryant's girlfriend. She asked us to hide her identity. They were together for 8 months and took several holidays interstate.
I remember we were in a restaurant in Sydney and he was looking at the age or something and I could tell he wasn't really reading it. I don't think he was that smart. He was only just pretending to try and impress me. And I remember smiling at him and pretending and going along with it to make him feel good about himself. Like, he could be smart. He was smart in some ways, but in some ways not very smart.
On another date, Bryant took her for a boat ride. They ran out of petrol and were stranded for hours.
And I started crying. He started crying. He started crying. He thought that was it. I thought we were going to die. I was hanging on to some hope that we might drift somewhere.
So in this boating mishap, Martin Bryant was crying because he thought he might die.
Yes.
Seems strange against all the evidence of him going in and shooting all these people where he told some people that he thought
he would either die or get captured. But he did it without crying.
I think he was genuinely remorseful that he got me in that situation too. Maybe he was just staring at me and he felt guilty.
Mary was 16. Bryant was 27. Despite their age difference, Bryant was serious about the relationship.
Did he ask you to marry him?
He did ask me to marry him, yeah.
What did you say?
I was honest with him. I didn't think he was too smart.
Did he love you?
Yeah, I think so.
Was he capable of love?
Yes, yeah.
You'll note that after Mary recounts how Bryant cried when he stranded them in his boat, Willesey says that Bryant's remorsefulness, as well as his concern for Mary, is surprisingly sensitive behaviour for a mass murderer. Yet we're expected to believe that Bryant, who'd burst into tears when his boat ran out of petrol, remained completely emotionless while he methodically and expertly shot 35 people dead. Apparently, the sight of blood spurting from bullet wounds in men, women, and screaming children failed to move him, but an empty petrol tank and his feeling he'd let his girlfriend down had him bawling his eyes out. Mullen claims that Bryant loved to torture animals, which is a common behavioural trait of deranged killers. But have a listen to what Bryant has to say in this clip from the police interrogation. The audio wasn't the greatest, so you might have to crank up the volume a little bit.
Shoot, 15 cans.
Oh, right. Bottles?
Bottles, no, not bottles, because they break and they could injure the animals.
Bryant said he didn't like to use glass bottles for target practice because the broken glass could injure animals. Now, does that sound like somebody who gets off on torturing animals? As for Mullen's claim that Bryant tormented his sister when he was young, name me one brother who hasn't tormented his sister at some point. All of the audio we've just heard completely contradicts Mullen's assessment of Bryant. But that's to be expected because Mullen's job wasn't to tell the truth about Bryant. Mullen's job was to demonise him, to make him fit the typical profile of a crazed mass shooter so that the public would believe he committed the massacre. The problem was that Bryant, apart from his social ineptitude, didn't fit the profile at all. And being socially inept does not in and of itself mean that somebody has a propensity for cold-blooded murder. If it did, then our prisons would be filled with nerds. The mainstream media has spread so many lies about Bryant to galvanise his guilt in the eyes of the public that documenting all of them would be extremely difficult. He was even accused at one stage of sleeping with a pig. Strange that his mother, who cleaned his house every week, never mentioned all the pig droppings that would have speckled his bed and the floor. Bryant's demonisation by Mullen and others would not be complete without his being characterised as a gun nut. Gun nut is a term that the political left uses to pathologise anybody with a healthy interest in firearms. In order for Bryant to be convincing in the role he'd been set up to play, he had to be seen as somebody morbidly obsessed with the kinds of weapons the government wanted to ban, that is, semi-automatic rifles. This presented another problem for his handlers, since he had no real interest in firearms, which is something that comes out in the police interrogation. In the transcript of the interrogation, a link to which I've posted in the show notes on my forum, one of the cops asks Bryant how often he practiced shooting. Cop: did you ever make your own targets to shoot? Bryant: I had a couple of targets on boards. Cop: and how many times would you have shot them? Bryant: oh, 4 or 5 times, and I used to put the gun back in the car and used to leave and go home. The Port Arthur shooter's marksmanship, stance and kill rate indicated that he'd been trained to a world-class standard. But here Bryant states that shooting practice for him consisted only of firing at a few targets a handful of times. A little later, one of the cops asks Bryant about his proficiency as a shooter. Cop: oh, right, and did you get pretty accurate? Bryant: no, not really, cause like I said, I only used that AR-15 about 20 rounds in that one, and not many round, more rounds than the AR-10. So, and I never got round to using the shotgun because of it. I heard from Terry that it had a bit of power to it. Terry is Terry Hill, the gun dealer who's alleged to have sold several firearms to Bryant. Again, Bryant makes it pretty plain that A, he wasn't much chop as a shooter, and B, at best he only had a casual interest in firearms. which raises the questions of why he bought the rifles to begin with. In particular, the shotgun, which he was scared to use, why, after buying his first rifle, he continued to buy them, and why his financial guardians, perpetual trustees, let him have thousands of dollars to buy them. It makes no sense unless you entertain the possibility that somebody behind the scenes was encouraging him to use firearms and saw to it that he obtained them. At one point in the interrogation, Bryant is shown a bag that the gunman left behind in the Broad Arrow Cafe. The bag had been filled with firearms. The police ask Bryant if he recognises it. He replies that he doesn't and is adamant that he doesn't. The police then tell him his girlfriend, Petra Wilmot, claims that she went with him when he was supposed to have purchased the bag. This presents a possibility that Wilmot was working in cahoots with Bryant's handlers, or that she was coerced by them to lie about the bag. The bag is a vital piece of evidence, for as we shall see, it's the only thing that ties Bryant to the shootings in the Broad Arrow Cafe. Wilmot doesn't strike me as somebody very bright, so I tend to think she was most likely coerced rather than deliberately working to frame Bryant. A couple of decades ago, videotape police interrogations of suspects became standard procedure in criminal investigations. You often see footage from these interviews in TV news reports. I must have seen dozens of them. The cops conducting the interrogations are always very cool, calm, and collected, because if they're seen to influence the suspect's answers by being aggressive, sarcastic, or frustrated, the evidence gleaned from the interrogations could be deemed inadmissible. However, in the Bryant interrogation, we have the bizarre spectacle of a woman chiming in every now and then to remind Bryant of the seriousness of his crimes and to chide him for giggling.
Bryant, it's not funny. Can't explain anything because I don't know any of that.
It's not funny, is it?
What is?
It's what I'm talking about. So why do you laugh?
Because it's good to get out of myself.
What she said to him in that clip has nothing on what she has to say to him in this next one.
What would you think about a person who has killed 35 people? What would you be your opinion of that person?
That's a wicked, awful, horrendous thing.
You won't.
And they reckon others were injured.
There were many injured. There were two little babies killed, shot. There have been many witnesses who have given very graphic description of you being responsible for killing those people.
It's sad, isn't it? It's horrendous. And the words are
I'm not sure who this woman is. I presume she's a cop. But the whole purpose of her being there seems to be to make Bryant look like a heartless loon, and after watching the interview footage shown on Sunday night, that's how most people will see him, if they didn't already. What she's doing is so highly prejudicial that if justice was seen to be done in this case, the entire interrogation and Bryant's confessions therein would be thrown out of court. But because the case is weighed down with so much emotional baggage, and people don't want to be accused of offending the memory of the dead, nobody but us conspiracy realists is prepared to point out these glaring violations of his legal rights. One of the most damning segments of the police interview is where Bryant confesses to kidnapping.
This sketch illustrates where Bryant went next, stopping his car at a toll booth where he killed four people in a BMW. He then stole the car and drove to a service station where he killed a woman and forced her boyfriend, Glenn Pears, into the boot of the BMW. The kidnapping was the only crime Bryant admitted to police.
I saw this car ride by and killing up the person in the car, kidnapped him.
How did this guy get in the boot?
I put him in the boot because I had the gun.
Which gun did you have?
I had the
Mr. Warren Holder.
AR-15. See, if people didn't do these unfortunate things, you guys wouldn't have a job.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, man. Let me tell you.
That one there. Yes, that was the one.
This is the one.
It's a sweet little gun. It's so light. How light is it?
Yeah. Do you remember what you said to this fellow?
Hey, mate, get out of your car, please. I'm going to take your car.
And you had this pointed at him, did you?
Yeah, I had it pointed at him. And moving backwards and forwards to this white child.
I don't believe a word of this story for a couple of reasons. The first is that in the transcript of the interrogation, Bryant claims that he drove past a gold BMW that he liked the look of so much he decided to steal it. Mind you, at the time he did this, he was supposed to be on his way to the Seascape Cottage, which is a bed and breakfast about 4 clicks from the Port Arthur Historic Site, to kill the owners out of revenge for not letting him purchase the cottage. The BMW had 3 occupants, a man, a woman, and a child. According to Bryant, he forced the man at gunpoint to get in the boot of the BMW and got the woman and the child to get into his Volvo. He then drove off, leaving the woman and the child behind. Bryant is a simpleton, but he's not insane. He must have known that the first thing the woman would have done was call the police to report the kidnapping and the stolen car. And why would Bryant complicate his alleged plans to kill the owners of the Seascape by kidnapping somebody on the way there, when every available cop in the area would be searching for the vehicle and were sure to find it in record time outside such a well-known landmark as the Seascape Cottage? The second reason is that before Bryant left home on the morning of the massacre, he set his house's burglar alarm. Why would he do this if he was planning to murder the owners of the Seascape and then as many people as he could at the Port Arthur Historic Site? Keep in mind that when he was supposed to have committed these murders, he did so without wearing any form of disguise. He didn't wear a mask over his face or a stocking over his head. Unless he killed absolutely everybody who saw him, many of the people who were at the site would have been able to ID him as the gunman. Yet he was fully expecting to be able to return home afterwards and live a normal life. Even Bryant would have to know that once he had killed his victims, returning home would be out of the question because that would be the first place the police would go looking for him. Now, some people might argue that he set the burglar alarm through force of habit. That's a possibility, but an unlikely one. Because that morning he told his girlfriend, who was going to spend the day with her parents, that he would see her the following Monday. Therefore, Bryant expected to return home that Sunday because he had no idea there was going to be an actual massacre. I believe he'd been told by his handlers that a mock terrorist attack was going to be staged at the Port Arthur Historic Site as part of a joint Tasmanian police force and special operations training exercise, and that he was going to have an important part to play in it. His handlers, or handler, would have been members of the Tasmanian police force. That's why Bryant grins and giggles throughout the interview, even when he's shown gruesome pictures of the victims. He thought it was all part of an elaborate training exercise and that none of it was real, which is why the female cop had to keep reminding him that the massacre was nothing to laugh at. With an IQ of about 70, Bryant has the mental maturity of an 11-year-old. So it would have taken him some time to twig that he was being framed for a genuine massacre, maybe more than a month. The following excerpt from the interrogation transcript proves that Bryant's recounting of events cannot be taken seriously. Cop: were you on your own when you went to Port Arthur? Oh, Roaring Beach that day? Bryant: yes. I was. I wish I'd took my girlfriend, but like I said, it's good for her to go home on a Sunday to her parents. Cop: all right, back to Seascape. So, Bryant: yeah, back to Seascape. Cop: you got out of the car? Bryant: back to the Pink Palace. Cop: is that what you used to call it? Bryant: yeah, most people down there used to call it the Pink Palace because it's pink. Cop: right, so you've got out of the BMW? Bryant: Cop: tip petrol. Where'd you tip the petrol? Bryant: I don't recall because it was a vast explosion and I had my gun strapped around me. Cop: which one? Bryant: the AR-15, there. Cop: the one Mr. Warren lifted up a short time ago? Bryant: yeah. Cop: right. And what did you do with that? Bryant: And I also had my shotgun. Cop, your shotgun? Bryant, yeah, and I don't remember anything else. Cop, where did you have the shotgun, Martin? Bryant, I left that in the Volvo. Cop, when you went to Seascape? Bryant, yeah. Cop, you left the shotgun in the Volvo. Bryant, yeah, because I was all shaky because I had this bloke hostage and... Cop, what about this, what about the lady? Bryant, yeah, I got her to go, get into the Volvo, so the child went in too. She was just there shocked, devastated. So... Cop, did you actually knock on the door at Seascape? Bryant, few times, went around the back, knocked on the door, no answer. Cop, do you remember talking to anyone that morning, that same morning at Seascape? Bryant, no. Cop, are you sure about that? Bryant, Cop, did you go inside at Seascape? Bryant, no, you can ask me questions. It'd be interesting if I could hear some of yours, you know, like your other, if you've got other things that you could tell me on your report. Cop, did you get the hostage's name? Bryant, no, not at all. Cop, so apart from Bryant, what have you got on your report? Is there other things that you reckon I've done down there? All right, now you could be forgiven for thinking I just read a skit from Monty Python's Flying Circus, if that ridiculous. But I'll break it down in an effort to make some sense of the nonsensical. So Bryant rocks up at the Seascape, or the Pink Palace as he calls it, which makes it sound like a strip joint, gets out of the BMW, straps his AR-15 around him, or already has it strapped around him, tips petrol somewhere, he's not sure where exactly or why, but sets off a ruddy great explosion as a result. He adds that he has his shotgun with him, the one he's reluctant to use because of its powerful recoil, but then says he left it in the Volvo with the woman. And although he doesn't state this outright, he seems to suggest that the Volvo was present at the Seascape, which means that the woman would have had to follow him there in the Volvo and at high speed, because in another part of the transcript he claims he drove there at 140 kilometres per hour in the BMW. And on top of all this, he says that if his girlfriend hadn't gone to see her parents, he would have taken her on his crime spree. It's no wonder that the government didn't want the case going to trial, because any decent defence lawyer would have torn that absurd version of events to shreds. Bryant is telling the cops what he thinks they want to hear. He still believes he's playing the role of the terrorist or some other role in a police training exercise, and he's being imprisoned and interrogated as part of that exercise. The key point in that excerpt is where he says, quote, "You can ask me questions. It'd be interesting if I could hear some of yours, you know, like your other, if you've got other things that you could tell me on your report," unquote. This indicates that Bryant, in his own inimitable fashion, was expanding upon information that the cops had given him previously, which means his answers were not truly his own and therefore false. A little later he says, quote, "What have you got on your report? Is there other things that you reckon I've done down there?" Unquote. Bryant asks this in the hope that they'll feed him enough information so he can answer any further questions. The corollary is that Bryant didn't do what he said he did, because if he had, he would have been able to recount events without having to keep looking to the police to, quote, jog his memory, unquote. It's significant that Bryant goes along with the official story of what happened at the Seascape Cottage, but not the official story of what happened at the Port Arthur Historic Site. He emphatically denies visiting the historic site on the day of the massacre. This is because his involvement with what he thought was a training exercise was restricted to the Seascape Cottage. His handlers didn't want him going anywhere near the historic site because then witnesses would have seen two Martin Bryants, the real one and the gunman who from a distance looked somewhat like him. As I said earlier, he was supposed to have died in the fire at the Seascape. He's surviving it through a major spanner in the works for the people who planned the massacre. This is why they had to go to great lengths to avoid a court trial and broke a raft of laws to put him behind bars post-haste for the rest of his life. A trial would have exposed the gaping holes of the official story and Bryant would have been found innocent. Australia's Bulletin magazine published a transcript of a conversation between Bryant and his lawyer John Avery, which contained this revealing exchange. Bryant, Mr. B, do you know Mr. B? Avery, I know Mr. B, yes, and Mr. D. Bryant, well, they are trying to brainwash me to not having a trial. Carl Wernerhoff, the author of the excellent book What's Going On? A Critical Study of the Port Arthur Massacre, had this to say about the exchange. Quote, "It is intriguing that the bulletin has suppressed the names of the two individuals who, unacknowledged in any public source concerning the Port Arthur case, were clearly part of some irregular or extra-legal form of pressure being exerted on Bryant. I know of no one involved with Bryant's case whose surname begins with D. However, Mr. B might well be Damien Bug QC." Unquote. In this next audio grab, Bryant makes a reference to his handlers.
What do you mean? I should be out. If I could get out on bail tomorrow, I'd pay the money.
Why do you reckon you should be out, Bob?
Because it's not fair on me, is it? I mean, I know I've done the wrong thing, but surely they can train me for a few months a year for what I've done. Well, you work things out.
At the beginning of the clip, Bryant complains that he's being treated unfairly and should be set free. This is not the kind of thing that somebody who's been locked up for killing 35 people would say. He also says that he knows he's done the wrong thing, as if he were referring to an act of petty theft rather than mass murder. Then he says that they could train him for a few months a year for what he's done. Who are the they he refers to here, and what sort of training does he mean? I believe that they are the people who, for more than a year before the massacre, groomed him to be the patsy for the crime. And Bryant was the ideal patsy. He was slow-witted, socially awkward, and his long blonde locks gave him a distinctive look that the real gunman could easily adopt by wearing a blonde wig. What Bryant is probably saying in this clip is that he thinks he's being punished for stuffing up the bogus police training exercise somehow. This is why he thinks his problems could be resolved through training. Mass murder, however, is not something that can be resolved through training. Once people have been murdered, they can't be unmurdered, and the only options available to the murderer are a life on the run or imprisonment. Bryant would have watched enough TV crime dramas and news reports on criminal investigations to be aware of the consequences of his alleged actions. So the wrong thing he refers to in the clip is not and could not be the Port Arthur massacre. If you read the transcript of the interrogation, and I've posted the PDF in the show notes on my forum, you'll see that some of the things Bryant has said were supposed to be inaudible on the audio recording of the interrogation. The word inaudible, in brackets, often appears throughout the transcript, 80 times to be exact, 71 of which are when Bryant is in the middle of answering a question. Carl Wernerhoff believes that up to 30% of the transcript is missing, almost one-third. That's a hell of a lot of potentially damaging evidence that's gone AWOL. Either the person responsible for recording the interrogation was Jerry Lewis, or the cops deliberately excised material that would have cast serious doubt on the official story. By far the most damning piece of footage on the Sunday night program is where Bryant confesses to committing the massacre, or at least seems to. The audio quality is really terrible here, but I thought it best to play the grab anyway, because when last I looked, the second part of the Sunday night report had been removed from the Channel 7 website, and the second part contains the confession.
In the police interview, there was one moment where Bryant dropped his guard. He thought they'd stopped recording.
I don't find that very funny statement at all, mate, to be quite honest.
You shouldn't put that on recording.
Oh, it's still recording at this present stage, so that is on recording.
If you couldn't make the audio out, this is what was said. Bryant, not until me lawyer sees me, I'm sure you'll find the person who caused all this. Me. Cop, I don't find that a very funny statement at all, Martin, to be honest. Bryant, you should have put that on recording. Cop, oh, it's still recording at this present stage, so that is on recording. It certainly seems that Bryant is confessing to the massacre here. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But Bryant is such a muddle-headed character that it would be hard, even at the best of times, to gauge what he was really thinking. Notwithstanding, I'm going to play the devil's advocate and assume that he is confessing to being the gunman. The first thing we need to consider is that a person who confesses to a murder or multiple murders isn't always the guilty party. Suspects in criminal investigations, especially those with a low IQ, have been known to confess to murders and other serious crimes they didn't commit in the hope that by telling the cops what the cops wanted to hear, they'd be released from custody. Now, to the average person, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but dim-witted folk who are freaking out at the prospect of going to jail aren't beholden to logic. They just think that their key to freedom is making the cops happy, and if that means confessing to murder, so be it. Then there are those people who confess to murder because they crave notoriety. Cops know only too well that every major murder investigation is going to draw its share of kooks who will insist they're the culprits. Is that what Bryant is doing? He confesses, but only when he thinks the police have stopped recording, which makes him seem cunning and manipulative, something that he most definitely is not. But in the end, a confession is only as good as the evidence that supports it. That's provided the evidence does support it. But the evidence in the Port Arthur case all points to Bryant not being the gunman. For starters, there is no hard evidence linking him to the shootings in the Broad Arrow Cafe. Bryant denies that the blue sports bag that the killer left in the cafe was his. If it was his, then why didn't the cops get his fingerprints off it? Eyewitnesses said that the gunman didn't start firing away when he entered the cafe. Instead, he bought some food and a can of drink, which he carried over to his table on a tray, and sat down and had them first. A police video of the crime scene revealed that he left the tray, the can of drink, and some eating utensils on the table. Bryant's DNA and fingerprints would have been all over these items, so why didn't the police produce this evidence to cement their case against him? Then there are the eyewitnesses who didn't identify Bryant as the gunman. They said the gunman was in his late teens or early 20s and had bad acne or a pockmarked face. Bryant was almost 29 at the time of the massacre and had an unblemished face. Jim Laycock, the co-owner of a motor inn at the entrance to the Port Arthur historic site, saw the gunman shoot two people dead. He knew Martin Bryant and said the gunman was not Bryant. Some eyewitnesses did identify Bryant as the gunman, but that was only after his face had appeared on the front cover of every newspaper in the country and in every TV news and current affairs show. In this next audio grab, Bryant discusses his so-called prowess as a shooter.
When you practiced shooting, where did you hold the gun?
On the left.
So you're left-handed?
Right with this hand.
Oh, that's right, sorry. Yeah.
This is
more. So if you held a gun, you would pull the trigger with your finger on your left hand?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. And did you ever practice shooting from the hip?
No, never.
Never?
In the video from which that audio grab was taken, Bryant shows the police that he writes with his right hand but shoots with his left. Witnesses to the Broad Arrow Cafe shootings reported that the shooter shot with his right hand and from the hip. Shooting from the hip would have enabled him to fire rounds in different directions quicker and made it harder for people to wrest his rifle from him. Neville Quinn, an ex-serviceman who was injured during the Broad Arrow shooting, said, quote, "He appeared to be the best-trained army guy I've ever seen. His stance was unbelievable," unquote. But as you heard in that clip, when asked by the police whether he'd practiced shooting from the hip, Bryant replied that he hadn't. And you can hear the surprise in the cop's voice because he'd know that Bryant could not have shot so efficiently in that manner without receiving extensive training. Another crucial point to consider is that when the shooter stood up, rifle at the ready, to commence the massacre, one of the customers, Anthony Nightingale, leapt to his feet and cried, "No, no, not in here." Now, you could imagine that given the circumstances, he would have cried, "No, please don't shoot," or something like that. But "no, no, not in here" implies that the gunman wasn't supposed to shoot inside the cafe, but rather somewhere else, which suggests that Nightingale had prior knowledge of the massacre. Carl Wernerhoff believes that Nightingale and a number of other people in the Broad Arrow Cafe were intelligence operatives who were there to monitor the massacre and that they were deliberately shot to eliminate any danger of their exposing who was really behind it. If that's a little on the far-fetched side for you, This is what Nicholas Emmanuel Cheok, who saw the gunman kill some people at the toll booth at the entrance to the Port Arthur Historic Site, had to say in his eyewitness statement. Quote, "As we approached the toll booth, I saw a BMW, which I think was a white colour, stopped on the road and was in our lane facing us. On the left side of the BMW, I saw a yellow Volvo station sedan, which was also facing us, but was on the correct side of the road. I saw a male person aged about 65 with whitish hair and wearing glasses in the driver's seat of the BMW and a lady in the front passenger's seat. She had dark brownish shortish hair and was about 52 years old. Both of these people were making worried gestures or hand signals as if to say stop and pointing for us to go back. Then I saw a man get out of the rear seat, driver's side, of the Volvo station sedan and just stand on the road near where he got out of the car. I noticed a woman about 45 years in the front passenger seat of the Volvo. I then saw a male person get out of the driver's seat of the Volvo. He had long blonde hair which was down below his shoulders. He had jeans and a wind cheater on, dark coloured. He was talking to the man that had got out of the back seat of the Volvo. The driver got out of the Volvo and walked over to him. From their body language, I could tell they were arguing. The blonde-haired male walked around the front of the Volvo when he went to the left side of the Volvo to the rear. This older male was just standing in the same place as when he had got out of the Volvo. When the blonde-haired male walked back to the older man, that's when I saw that he was carrying a gun. It was just a large gun to me. There was a bit more talking between the blonde-haired male and the older male. And then the blonde-haired man lifted up the gun and pointed it at the chest of the older man. Then I heard the blast, and the older man's chest just seemed to cave in and he fell to the ground. I then saw the driver of the BMW open his door and get out, and he walked around the front of the BMW towards the back in the general direction of the blonde-haired male and the older man who was lying on the ground. Unquote. Keith Allen Noble comments on this eyewitness statement in his book Mass Murder, Official Killing in Tasmania, Australia. Quote, "In relation to these two points, the witness uses the words talking and spoken. This witness and two others were seated in a vehicle only a few metres in front of the gold-coloured BMW. They saw two older men from that BMW, one at a time, talking with the gunman. They could see the gunman was being spoken to. Not one of these witnesses said there was yelling or any wild threatening gesticulations going on. After the first man was shot point blank in the chest, the second man from the BMW walked toward the gunman, whose most recent victim was still warm at his feet, and began to converse with him. Any normal person would have sensed danger and got out of there as fast as possible, but not this Russell Pollard. He got out from behind the steering wheel of that BMW and walked over to and spoke with the gunman. Then he, too, was shot point blank in the chest." Unquote. What this tells us is that the people in the cars who the gunman conversed with and then shot dead were known to him and didn't expect to be killed by him. If the gunman, as the official story would have us believe, was killing people willy-nilly at the Port Arthur Historic Site, why weren't they afraid of him? They weren't afraid because they, like Anthony Nightingale, were there to monitor the massacre, not to be victims of it. At least that's what they thought. Bryant didn't arrive at the Seascape Cottage until approximately 12:30 p.m., but witnesses said they heard shots coming from there at 10:40 a.m. That's almost 2 hours earlier. At the time they heard the shots, a man called Gary King said he saw Bryant drinking coffee in a coffee shop 50 kilometres away. Therefore, Bryant could not have been the shooter in the Seascape. This fact alone demands a royal commission into the Port Arthur massacre. Not that we shall ever see one. Martin Bryant will probably die in prison, the victim of the greatest miscarriage of justice in Australian legal history. There are too many inconsistencies in the official story of the Port Arthur massacre for me to cover all of them in detail in one episode. But what I haven't been able to cover, the book by Wernerhoff and the book by Noble have, and I highly recommend you check both of them out. They really do make for eye-opening reading. You can download both of them in the show notes on my forum and on my blog. If there's one thing both authors fail to deal with properly, though, it's why the massacre occurred. They say that the government, with perhaps the help of some offshore agencies, planned the massacre to take away most of our firearms. But they fail to address the underlying question of why the government wanted to take away our firearms. What future event had the government so worried that we might take up arms against it that it saw fit to orchestrate the murder of 35 people in order to disarm us? Last year, I did a podcast about the dire consequences of the mass buy-up of real estate, and in particular prime agricultural land in Australia by the Chinese. The Chinese are taking over this country not by force of violence, but by force of their greater economic power. At the rate they're buying us out, it won't be long before they control the food chain here. And if they control the food chain, they control us. Take a walk through our major cities and you'll see more Chinese than whites or any other race, likewise in our universities. And the increase in their numbers shows no sign of abating. Some decades ago, probably in the late 1960s, our political leaders were told by the United Nations that Australia would eventually become a part of the People's Republic of China. They were told that the growing Asian superpower would need more land, and a lot of it, in the near future to accommodate its already enormous population. But rather than allow the Chinese to take it by armed force, which would result in great loss of life for the host population, the Chinese would be allowed to take it peacefully through immigration and by the gradual acquisition of real estate. That's why the White Australia policy had to go, and why in the 1970s our politicians began to stress that we needed to embrace the idea that Australia is part of Asia. Not long after this, some of the more racially aware white Australians and even some politicians began to warn about the Asianisation of Australia. Their warnings proved well-founded. The Port Arthur massacre took place to help facilitate the long-range plan for the Chinese takeover of this country. We whites can't resist the takeover without weapons, so the Australian government, at the behest of the UN, took away our guns, or most of them, and continues to do everything it can to discourage and pathologise gun ownership here. Our politicians often boast that there hasn't been a gun massacre in Australia since the new gun laws were introduced after the Port Arthur massacre, but that's only because the government hasn't needed to stage another massacre. And therein lies a satanic irony of which most white Australians are sadly unaware. We can blame our politicians and the Jews all we like for the downfall of Australia and other white countries, and both groups have had undeniable parts to play in it, but ultimately we the white people are to blame for our predicament. God warned our people thousands of years ago that if they disobeyed his law, they would suffer the consequences. One of them being that their countries would be invaded by people not of their race who would gain power over them and treat them cruelly. They disobeyed and were invaded. That warning applies to our people today. Not that we as a people are heeding it. The other morning I heard a Melbourne radio host chatting with that galloping Marxist, Daniel Andrews, the Premier of Victoria, about a gay pride museum that's to be built here in Melbourne. Then the host went on to discuss the Chinese land grab in Australia. Like most white people in this country, he failed to see the connection between the two topics. There is only one way to halt our country's slide into multicultural oblivion, and it's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray, and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Until white Australians do all of the above, our country will remain in the hands of foreigners and life for us will become worse and intolerable. I'm quite partial to love songs, but have yet to play one on CIOz. It's high time I fix that. So here is my all-time favourite Aussie love song performed by John English, who sadly passed away earlier this year. It's called Words Are Not Enough. And just a reminder that you're listening to Christian Identity Australia, love songs and dedications.
The times might get rough. spend my